So think about food security earlier.
And they say, well, you're just lazy. Get a job.
That's a classic persecutor posture. What we often do is we swing to the other extreme and say, oh, you poor thing, let's just give you food for 30 years. And it's like, that's rescuing. A better posture, we'd say, well, actually, we want to help, but we want to help you find solutions that will be good for you now and for long term, so you can walk on your own.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Funk, and today I'm really excited to have and be joined by Dale Campbell. Dale, welcome to the show. It's good to have you.
Good morning, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Cool, man. And usually this is a time where I read off the accolades and accomplishments and degrees and honorific titles of my guests, but Dale and I decided to kind of go into this blind. I don't know much about him at all. So Dale, tell us a little bit about yourself. I can hear your American accent. Where are you from?
Yeah, Northern Hemisphere, United States.
Okay. What part of the U.S.?
Missouri.
Missouri.
Yeah, it's right in the middle. The Osage Nation people, the indigenous peoples of the United States, were around that region. Yeah.
Okay. And how long have you been in New Zealand?
20 years.
20. It's about like me. My wife, Donna, and I came in 2004.
Yeah.
I felt a call of God to come here. What brought you here? What was the call or the draw?
Well, there was a mission trip to go save the Kiwis, you know, these pagan heathen Kiwis, you know, 2004.
Cannibals.
Yeah. So we came down and we're just doing some ministry, prayer walking. There was this legend Kiwi guy named Dr. Bernard Holmes who would lead teams back every now and then. And so we just came to this Open Brethren Church, Narea Avenue Bible Chapel, and they happened to be looking for a youth pastor at the time. So I sometimes joke that because I could play the guitar and I had an American accent,
yeah,
it made me a high candidate for that role.
Yeah. Were you surprised to learn there was such thing as an American accent? Because when I first came here, I was like, what? No. Everybody else in the world has accents.
That's right.
Not Americans.
Yeah. There's a few accents in the States as well, of course.
Yeah, different dialects, different regions and stuff. So you said you brought a wife, a family over?
Well, I don't know why I said we, because it was just me at that stage.
Okay.
I did meet my lovely, amazing wife, Di Campbell. And so we got married in 2006, and we've got a 16-year-old boy. Yeah.
Well, cool. And I did Google you a teeny bit, and so you're involved with the Auckland Churches Network. Is that Auckland Church Network? What is
that?
What do you do with them?
Yeah, I mean, really simply, our vision is for Auckland to flourish. It's a very, very Kingdom of God vision. We want Auckland to flourish socially and spiritually. And so we talk about pursuing prayer together. We talk about connecting leaders together, planting churches together, and serving neighborhoods together, all to partner with churches and like-minded organizations to love and build the city.
Huh? Yeah. And how many churches are in the network?
Well, it's a bit of a spectrum, you know, like everyone's invited to the prayer breakfast. We think there's over 1,000 churches in Auckland. And, you know, we know of 21 pastors networks, or 22 that are affiliated with us. It's a broad, sprawling city, you know, and so we don't actually do like membership or anything like that. But there's just some key events and initiatives.
Yeah. And how long has it been going, this church network?
Jonathan Dove, pastor of Grace City, is the chair of Auckland Church Leaders, and he had a vision to take that ethos more active and widely throughout the city. And Ben Mai, who used to work for CAP and Stats and Zid, he's the manager of Auckland Church Network, and so they started it around mid-2022. So it is a relatively new startup.
Yeah, relatively new. Are you getting momentum? You're getting more and more churches involved with it.
It's a real privilege to partner and work with churches. So many different types of churches as well. You know, it's just brilliant.
Very ecumenical.
Absolutely. It's all about unity, collaboration, mission, oneness.
Yeah, okay, kingdom, so that's kingdom built right into the fabric of it. Good.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan Dove, he's associated with our church.
Yeah.
Shore Community Church with Reuben Munn. So I would be surprised if we weren't a member, part of the network.
You're a great church. We love partnering with Shore Community.
Good. Do you know Pastor Reuben?
Absolutely. He lives just up the road from me.
Does he?
Shore Community is participating in the North Shore Food Drive at the moment that we're coordinating on the North Shore. Yeah. It's a winter time. The budgets are tight. People are putting their heaters on. Cost of living is going up. So yeah, that's one initiative that we do to try to serve neighborhoods together, you know.
Right. Around. Yeah. And what do you do, Dale, kind of in a day-in, day-out method, day-in and day-out? Are you part of a church? Are you a pastor or elder at a church? Or,
I've done all that. I've been a pastor, been an elder. I'm not currently, but my local church is Birkenhead Community Church. So we're presently without a pastor. So I'm running an Alpha course, just trying to help out where that's helpful. Help with a bit of preaching, you know, I'll prepare communion or morning tea, whatever's needed.
Huh?
Yeah. It's a good church.
And do you work in New Zealand? I mean, like as in a secular vocation, or you got a partnership team out of the States, or how does that work?
Blessed that Auckland Church Network is my paid role. Yeah, really blessed. Yeah. Those two full-time employees, Ben Mai and myself. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And how did you meet Rowan Locke, the CEO of Thinking Matters? Because he's the one that connected us. Yeah. He said, hey, I've got to interview you. So here we are.
You know, I've been interested in apologetics and defending the faith and, you know, having reasons why we believe for it for a long time. I think there's been various iterations of leadership for Thinking Matters. So I've been connected to various people. One name that tumbles out of my brain is Matthew Flanagan, one of our local apologists. So I've known some of these guys through... There was this outfit called Theology and the Natural Sciences Aotearoa. They used to do some things. I used to go to that. We hosted a conference at the church I worked at. And so I think I met Rowan in 2023 at Church Unlimited. They run this New Zealand Beyond conference. I think met him face to face, and we're like, hey, he's a cool guy.
Cool. And so have you been to any of the Thinking Matters events or conferences or any of those? Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Great stuff. I mean, there's the Forge events and there's the conferences and, you know, it's lovely.
Yeah. And if I were to ask you, which I am going to ask you, what is the passion of your heart? What makes you get up every morning ministerial wise? What floats your boat with that, Dale?
I mean, one of my driving passions, and it really fits with my role at Auckland Church Network, is for unity in the midst of real difference, because we really are very different as Christians and as humans. And it's just a miraculous, beautiful thing when you see people put aside some of those differences and pursue some kind of relationship or oneness, unity or collaboration. Yeah. It's what I live for, really.
Yeah. Well, and as an apologist, if you're an apologist, then obviously truth matters and doctrine matters. And how do you, you know, balance that tightrope walk between what the Bible says and solid doctrine versus, you know, stuff that's aberrant?
Yeah, you're talking about the tension that you must face when it comes to these things. We must wrestle with the tension between purity and unity. You know, we are not... I mean, we at Auckland Church Network, we use very generous, broad framework for churches that we will work with. And it's the Nicene Creed. It's just like that. That's a trans-historic, trans-cultural creed. It's a very generous statement of faith that basically all Christians across cultures and continents have believed. There are so many other issues that you could debate and should debate, but not divide over.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
But that's the key thing is trying to work out what's an essential top tier belief and what's a secondary belief that's really important, but we can still pray together, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I've known of organizations in the States back when I was there whose primary goal was to get a whole bunch of different variant churches and denominations together, kind of at the expense of any core belief values, you know, and it was kind of unity for unity's sake rather than,
that's right,
you know, unity in the essentials, which is, you know, what we need.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this, like the Auckland Prayer Breakfast is probably the most generous expression of unity that we do. It's just like literally anyone, any Nicene Christians in the city, you are welcome. Come on. Not every church will be interested in every last aspect, like some churches are not big on church planting or discipleship or multiplication, so we do have those core beliefs, but it's like it's good to have those moments where the things that do divide us don't matter.
Yeah, for sure. Do Catholics join in on this?
Absolutely.
Are they part? Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I just had a coffee last week with Bishop Steve Lowe, and he's just got a deep heart for unity amongst Christians and to learn from one another. A very humble heart, actually. Yeah. It's a love of the Catholics.
And so with the Auckland Church Network, is your primary responsibility to garner participation, make itself known out there and gather more churches into it? Would you say that?
Well, we like to think that it's not about like getting more members. You know, we don't have like membership, Auckland Church Network membership or anything like that. But it's more about coming alongside the church and just seeking opportunities that we discern together might be fruitful. And one of those is obviously the prayer breakfast that we just sense that people really lean into that. You know, we had more people come last year than ever before, 650 leaders at Eden Park there, and looking forward to October 30th gathering again this year. But yeah, like, and so like, whether it's planting churches, like those pillars that I mentioned earlier, you know, we sense that as we talk and get alongside leaders, people want to do this. They want to serve their neighborhoods, and they realize that it's better to do it with other churches in collaboration. So you might have churches in a particular neighborhood that they might have 4 food banks, but no CAP program. Christians Against Poverty, no budgeting service. And so when we get to know one another, we know what other churches are doing, and we don't have to each do everything. We can work together.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I mean, you talked about the ecumenical, you know, unity in the midst of diversity, but how does the cultural diversity that we see in New Zealand and Auckland specifically, how does that factor in? Because there are some very culturally diverse, you know, churches and people in Auckland.
Yeah, it would be very easy to say, you know, culture doesn't matter. We're all one in Christ, you know, and there's neither Jew nor Gentile. My understanding is that, you know, like God delights in the richness of our culture, and the one light of the gospel shines through all of our beautiful culture. So it's a profound privilege to do this in one of the most diverse cities in the world, you know, African, Asian. They even let some people from the States hang out in the church.
Do they? Well,
they even accept us.
They're quite accepting then, aren't they?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Cool. And you know, I did see you on your Radio Rhema interview, and it seemed like you had a real heart for, you know, reaching beyond our own cultures, our own comfort zones, and, you know, accepting other cultures, good, bad. I love your challenge that you put forth that, you know, we tend to see our own culture with rose-colored glasses and others with kind of dark-colored glasses. You know, we tend to forget our own. I mean, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, like it's basically Matthew 7, you know, like we our instinct is to kind of assume that our ways of doing things are normal. You know, we're just normal. It's fine. It's good. And we look at someone else's way of doing something, their culture, and we want to critique it. But I think it's really a good gospel Sermon on the Mount kind of impulse to say, well, hang on, before I try to take the speck out of someone else's culture or their eye, I better look at mine. And, you know, because Western culture, very individualistic, very rationalistic.
Yes.
Consume. Yeah. I mean, it's just like
probably especially in Americans, I would say. Well, you know, looking at us.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with country music, though. That's that's the one thing that you can't critique about United States culture.
That's a non-negotiable, you know, right there.
It's just good.
Yeah. 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 I started noticing that just as we would have guests from the United States come and visit us, friends and family, and driving on the you know, on the left side of the road was the wrong side of the road. Why do you drive on the wrong side of the road?
That's right.
That's right. If, you know, driving on the right was the right side of the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just a funny way of looking at life. And we drag that into the kingdom too with our nuances of what we emphasize, like you say, individualism versus culture and family.
That's right. Absolutely. You got to keep coming back to what matters.
Yeah. Do you do talks or emphasis on multiculturalism or anything like that? I mean, I saw you had a greenstone on, at least in the Rhema interview. I don't know if you have it on today.
Yeah. I do. It's, I mean, we could get it because I guess eventually we want to talk about this sort of social justice and drama triangle stuff. But I try to present myself not as someone who is trying to rescue Maori people or be, you know, to display my non-racism, you know, look at me, I'm not racist, but just to be someone who honors the treaty, who is aware of the story of how the gospel has come to this land and how beautifully it was received. And yeah, it's just someone who knows the story and wants to live in partnership with Māori as a tanga te tiriti, person of the treaty. I think there's a lot of God soaked through that treaty and its story. So yeah, that's my heart on that particular issue.
Are you bilingual? Are you Te Reo?
Not in the least. It's very performative. One thing I will say on that, which has been kind of funny, like, I remember when I was leaving Tearfund, or one of the colleagues was leaving Tearfund. She's like, "Oh, I've one thing that I'll really miss about working here at Tearfund Dale is your Te Reo Māori is so good, you know." And I was like, "I've learned so much from you." And I'm like, "Really? That's I barely funny. Used any of it, and I'm not very good at it." But I think what helps is that I didn't grow up mispronouncing certain place names like Whangarei or Tauranga or Taupo. So I've learned Taupo, Tauranga. I've learned it because it's new to me. I came here in 2005 when people were really starting to put a lot of emphasis on correct pronunciations.
Okay, you're lucky you hung around the
public. So yeah, I haven't had to unlearn. Mm-hmm. And that gives me a little bit of mercy for people who have grown up here and have learned it Tauranga. It is a little bit difficult to change when you've got 30 years of saying it a certain way.
Yeah, well, your pronunciation of vowels and consonants, you know, and you learn that. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And so you mentioned, you know, social justice, and I noticed on the Rhema interview you did talk about that, and you did seem to kind of light up. That seemed to spark a bit of fire underneath you.
Well, look, I mean, there's a bit of a story how I got into this. Like, when I was a pastor and preacher, I've always been drawn to the themes of the kingdom and like this belief that the kingdom starts now. We're not just saved so that we can go to heaven after we die, but God has a job for us to do now. So thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So I've always favored that kind of practical Christianity. It's something to do. So then that carried through when I went to Tearfund. And what a beautiful organization Tearfund is, seeking justice for people facing poverty and slavery.
How long did you work for Tearfund?
Well, I worked, this is part of the story. I worked there from 2019 to 2022. And that was, you had COVID-19 lockdowns.
Yeah.
The season of COVID. You had George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, probably Me Too, and other various things that were happening. I was working increasingly during my time. I got involved in the Justice Conference and the education theology sort of area. And so, yeah, that was really an interesting learning journey for me to really do a lot of listening locally around treaty issues, you know, and I'm really grateful to organizations like Karufa, which is named after Henry Williams, who was called Karufa, which means four eyes. So, because he wore glasses.
Uh-huh.
But I'm really grateful for organizations like that that help us to know the gospel story behind the treaty. But yeah, so I mean, as I listened to people talk about justice, and the Justice Conference was this thing where we try to talk about justice from a biblical perspective, not a secular perspective, but a biblical basis. And as I listened to conversations both inside that conference, outside that conference, you know, various spaces, I saw what I think a lot of us can see, this very simplistic binary. We end up dividing people sometimes into simple categories of you're an oppressor or you're oppressed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so like—
theory.
Totally, totally. And I mean, there's probably some features in some of these discourses that are good, and we can get into that. But I just thought, no, we need to do some, we need a better framework. So I was drawn to a different framework, and we can talk about that later. Yeah.
Hey, who's the guy? Is it Neil Chevney that has written so extensively on critical theory and how it differentiates from biblical justice versus, you know, social justice in the popular terms?
I've seen a few book titles over the years of people responding to critical theory and trying to engage with it. Some people tend to take it wholesale, say critical theory is great. Some people tend to just reject everything and say everything that they said is bad. And some people are trying to pick out the good from the bad.
Yeah. And I'm sure for younger people, well, not just necessarily younger, but those who are not fully biblically literate, it's easy to just get swept into Marxism and the critical theory and, you know, because it sounds good.
Yeah.
Some of the programs and stuff that you know, the money giveaway programs, it sounds very merciful and good, but
totally.
When you examine it and the fruits of it, especially, it can go really wrong, as we both know.
That's right. I mean, one really quick example, we were talking about the food drive.
Mm-hmm.
on the North Shore. Sophie Gray is she runs the Good Works Trust. And I host a podcast myself called For the City. If anyone's interested, there's a few episodes there on this issue, one with her. And her view, which I totally agree with, is that we don't actually need more food banks. We don't need more people being given more food for years and years and years. That's not a great story.
Right.
That's dependency.
Yes.
That is not helpful. It may look like love in the short term.
Yeah.
But the best food bank is a food bank that makes themselves not needed because they've actually helped people. They've given people a step up in their life so they can get into self-supporting ways of being.
Yeah. I'm a little over 60 and I just clicked onto that concept, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. Of course.
Yeah.
I read a book called When Helping Hurts. You know,
that's it.
That revolutionized my thinking.
Yeah. 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 It's a great book. Another one is Walking with the Poor by Bryant Myers. Tear Fund recommends both of those books.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of people with Tear Fund use those books.
So Tear Fund's very switched onto that concept of, you know, truly helping people versus, you know,
token
them and what.
That's right. And that plays into the social justice stuff, which we can get to. But yeah, absolutely. There's this international development. Several people that work in the international programs team at Tear Fund, they often have masters or degrees in international development. And one of the main principles is that we have to avoid the sort of the savior complex, you know, or what Bryant Myers or Yakamura Christian calls the God complexes of the materially non-poor.
Yeah,
we think we can just go over with money, sprinkle it around, or our ideas even. And we end up actually sending a message that you're defined by what you don't have. You know, because poverty is not just economic. It's emotional, relational.
Yeah.
It's very complex. And so, yeah, we have to be very careful how we try to help people.
Yeah. And while I'm a fan of short-term mission trips, I think it helps open the eyes of Western young people when they go on them, more than it actually helps what's going on in the other countries they go to.
Well said. I've heard them recently called exposure trips.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of value to actually see and learn from these people.
Yeah. We've had a lot of young people from our church and older people too go to Denpasar and help, you know, the Mums with Bubs programs. And they come back really with a different view, a different worldview, a different, you know, take on how blessed they are, the responsibility they have, and, you know, what we can do with that.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Has your 16-year-old, has he gone on any mission trips, you know, done any of that kind of stuff?
Not yet. He's actually going to the States for a school trip very soon.
Really? What's he going to do there?
Drama, music, things like that, so...
Yeah,
we're looking forward to that. But no, we did name his middle name is Isaiah because our prayer is that he would have a prophetic biblical heart for the poor, for the marginalized, for the vulnerable.
Yeah, excuse my ignorance. What does Isaiah mean? Or is that you're just talking about the book of Isaiah and what?
Just the book of Isaiah. Okay. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
So you just have the one son.
Yeah. One son. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. And does your wife, does she work in the ministry as well?
Yeah, she's actually on Radio Rima. She's been on the air for 20 years. She's just come off and she's now looking after all the shows for Radio Rima.
If you know the program I'm referring to, was she the one? There was a guy, I think his name was Andrew, and then there was another woman there interviewing you. Was
it Andrew and Kat? That was me. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've mentioned getting into social justice a few times. I think you're chomping at the bit with that. What's your passion with that?
Yeah. Well, look, as I listened to the discourse, another framework came to mind, you know, because very often we have this binary between oppressed and oppressor.
Yes.
And it's not that that's not biblical. It's not that the Bible doesn't use oppression language. Like one illustration that I usually give is Isaiah 58, where the prophet is speaking to Israel and he's saying, you know, you, Israel, are oppressing all your workers. So he's effectively saying, Israel, you're engaging in oppression, and so your workers are oppressed. And he's kind of positioning himself as a kind of an ally to those who are oppressed. So that framework in and of itself, it's not that it's not biblical. It's just that's not solution focused. It's critical. It's pointing out problems rather than solutions. And so as I thought about this, I thought, well, how can we, you know, you just can see things like this play out. And so this framework that came to mind was called the drama triangle. I don't know if you've ever heard of the drama triangle, if your listeners.
But as I think I snooped in on your Facebook, yes, and I saw a couple of posts, like a red one and a green one. And
yes.
Yeah, tease that out.
Okay. I mean, in some ways, I sometimes say this. So I ended up writing a journal article on this, and that's where those images come from. It's in Laidlaw's stimulus journal. And I guess, so it's a much better presentation, I guess, than a radio interview, perhaps, because you get those visuals. But I think we can do a good job here. So the drama triangle is about the rescuer, the persecutor, and the victim. So that's the triangulation.
Okay.
And for me, that just so neatly layers onto the social justice discourse stuff, because you have the oppressed, the oppressor, and the ally. And so that the same dynamics play out. So what happens in the drama triangle is that the persecutor will blame the victim for the state that they're in. So think about food security earlier. Some people tend to take a blaming posture towards people that are food insecure. And they say, well, you're just lazy. Get a job. It's all your fault. That's a classic persecutor posture. What we often do is we swing to the other extreme and say, oh, you poor thing, let's just give you food for 30 years.
Yes.
And it's like, that's rescuing. If we took a better posture, we'd say, well, actually, we want to help, but we want to help you find solutions that will be good for you now and for long term, so you can walk on your own. So I saw this playing out in social justice, you know. And so between an oppressed person who feels like a victim, that they often want to not only resist oppression, but they will take revenge. And so that is what keeps that cycle alive. And it's like a cycle of vengeance. And that we see that play out between countries throughout human history.
Yeah.
Arguably, we're seeing it right now.
Yeah.
On our news screens, just back and forth, round and round it goes.
Or an entitlement mentality that they somehow deserve what their perceived oppressor has.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah. And so another dynamic that can play out is between the rescuer or the ally and the victim. And so that they want to support, but they do that in ways that actually are like from a posture of superiority. And it actually ends up making the person, the victim, passive, and it doesn't actually empower their agency, their voice, their experience. And so it ends up becoming quite token. And there's this concept called performative allyship, where, hey, look at me, I'm not racist. Hey, look at me, I'm not sexist. Hey, look at me, I'm not whatever.
Is that the virtue signaling that we hear about? Virtue signaling,
yep, performative allyship. And it's a thing. I mean, I have felt the temptation to do that at times in my life, you know, when I have felt like I need to demonstrate that I'm on the right side of history. I'm on the right side of this issue, you know, but when it becomes about me and how I'm seen, that's when it becomes rescuing, you know, and that's not helpful.
Right. Well, and I just glanced at it because I didn't understand it, but it seemed like there was a red triangle, probably the bad in it all,
and then
a green triangle, which what we should be. Where's that triangle? Where the attitude should be and where the help should be and that.
So just one more dynamic, and we'll get to that green one, because that's where it all gets solved.
Okay.
The final dynamic is between the persecutor and the rescuer, where the rescuer wants to critique, or let's say the ally wants to critique the oppressor.
Yes.
And so I guess there's this idea that if we just critique them enough, they'll change, which actually—
Yeah, we know that works. Right.
It doesn't
work. We all receive critique so well, don't we, as Christians even.
Exactly. So they just get more defensive. And so you have this ugly, you have cycles of vengeance, cycles of dependency, and cycles of what I call enmity. And so nobody gets helped. And so, you know,
I've seen that so many times, haven't we? Gosh.
Yeah. And it's just so familiar. And so what I actually reached for was we need a systemic change in the way that we relate to others and to ourselves. Because this system, this toxic triangular system, it thrives on not critiquing myself and critiquing others. So going back, the verse that I reached for in the article is Micah 6:8. Which says, do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. And if you take mercy and humility, I mean, those are precisely the dynamics that undo the drama. Because I need to have mercy on the other in some form, and I need to be in some way humble to myself. That might mean that I just admit to myself that maybe I don't know everything about the situation. Maybe I don't know their motives, so I shouldn't judge them. Or maybe I don't know what the best way to help people is. That's humility.
Yes.
You know, mercy is, well, maybe they have done some wrong, but maybe I'm judging their motives, or maybe I'm misrepresenting the degree to which they have done a wrong. And I'm actually demonizing them. I'm not just critiquing them, I'm demonizing them.
Right.
I'm not just resisting them, I'm actually taking vengeance, you know. So mercy and humility undo the drama, all dynamics around the triangle. Yeah.
I love it.
Me too.
And that's just pretty, you know, when we think about that, that's the Christ-like way to look at things. Easy to say, easy to preach.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
And it's hard to live, especially when you have these news and media pundits that are putting the worst of the worst out there politically.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Painting
That's right.
pictures of the extremes of this and the extremes of that. And it does incite us to anger and incite us to insecurity, you know, just all the worst of the worst.
Well, these media, like the news media, comes to us on devices like screens and phones where we get our entertainment. And so there's kind of a self-serving role that media, you know, and I'm not trying to be simplistic in critiquing media, because my wife works in media, I have friends in media, so such a valuable contribution they make to human life. But what inevitably ends up happening is that we are attracted to, and we click on the stories that make us feel the way we want to feel. So I want to feel on the right side of history. I want to hate this person or that country. I want to feel better than. So that shapes the way that we
engage. That hurt, Dale. That's because I'm clicking on some of that stuff.
Yeah, we all do it. It's designed for that, I think.
But I realize, you know, I've got to limit the amount of media I take in, and some of these, you know, far right wing sites that are going to put up the worst of the left.
That's right.
Clear, whatever. Yeah.
Both sides do it. And I'm glad you said that, because I think it is, like, right now we're seeing a season in history where it seems like there's a little bit of pushback against what we would call the extreme left. But I personally don't want to energize the extreme right either. Because I don't want to get into, you see some kind of nasty critiques coming from some right wing personalities that they just don't seem Christ-like.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
You know, and I'm like, well, that's not Jesus either.
Yeah, we see it, especially in American politics, just the politics creeping into the pulpit, you know, the politics creeping into our you know, our Christianity, our lives,
right.
And easy to do.
That's right.
And in some ways, it just seems natural. Sometimes you have preachers out there that are just as rabid as, you know, the politicians.
And of course, the gospel is down to earth. The gospel, the kingdom is down to earth. So therefore, God would fully intend that we would take our gospel faith into all of our lives, whether we're collecting rubbish, preparing food, building houses, or working in the political sphere, local government, national government. There's nothing wrong with us trying to make a difference. But when we become so political, where we think that God is associated with one party and not the other, and when we take sides and it becomes, we make the gospel is politics, then that's a problem.
Yeah. Would you say in any way that the Auckland Church Network is trying to formulate kind of a pushback against the extreme theological differences that we put in the first and four in front of people and helping people, and, you know, the full gospel, you know, not the social gospel that has negative connotations.
But yeah. Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Well, we use the terms social and spiritual flourishing because we feel like that encapsulates a biblical vision of shalom. You know, this Hebrew concept of peace, shalom, not just, oh, we're not at war, but relational flourishing in all directions.
Yeah.
Shalom. I'm in a state of shalom if I'm in just beautiful, flourishing relationship with God, with myself, with others, and with the created order that God has given us to look after. And so we feel like, you know, shalom in Auckland, churches should be about that. And that's not just social justice stuff. We're about planting churches. We're about multiplying disciples. We're about the gospel being proclaimed, the name of Jesus being declared, people coming to faith. We want to see that happen. But we also want to see neighborhoods better because there's churches in those neighborhoods that care practically, whether you become Christian or not.
For sure.
Yeah.
How often do you see at those, at the prayer breakfasts, people of not extreme, but different theological bents and denominations get together, sit down at the same table, pray together, and actually like each other, surprisingly?
One of the joys, I think it was last year, Bishop Steve Lowe hunted me down. He said, look, where can I, can you connect me with the Pentecostal Church Unlimited folks? You know, I'd love to talk with them and pray with them. Yeah, yeah. And I just thought, that's it. That's so cool.
Yeah.
I mean, because I studied worship for my master's thesis at Cary Baptist, and so I love liturgy. I love liturgy. I love the traditions and patterns of worship. But gosh, you know, so there's some big debates and conversations around set prayers, spontaneous prayers, spiritual gifts, all that stuff. But when you can just put all that aside and be one, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny, we had some people coming on tour, Carl Faze and Mike Bird. And one of the discussions we had at North Cross was just about why there's so many, especially young people, millennials, gravitating out of Protestantism towards Catholicism. And they said liturgy, they want the candles, they want the mass, they want some of that. And I was like, okay, well, what can we do as Protestant churches to kind of help with that? Yeah.
I went along to that session at Laidlaw. They had a lunch, and the quiet revival is probably what they're referring to, and people are. My understanding is that people are going to three denominations more than others. They're going to Pentecostals, Catholics, and Orthodox.
Okay.
And the question came to mind at a conference. Someone was, it was actually Chris Clark of Wilberforce. He was leading a session at a conference I was participating in. And he asked the question, he's like, what's the common denominator between all those three? Pentecostals, Catholics, Orthodox. And the answer is that they all take the presence and power of God seriously.
Hmm.
Pretty cool, eh?
Yeah, the presence of power of God seriously.
One in a reverent, traditional, patterned way. And one in a dynamic, seeking the power and presence of God, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've been listening to some data. My niece is thinking about converting to Catholicism in California.
Okay.
So I've been listening to some of the stuff she sent to me, Joe Heschmeyer, and I've come to a great appreciation of how much they revere Christ in the Mass.
Yes.
Not quite there yet with transubstantiation,
sure.
But I appreciate that.
Yeah.
They do have a high reverence for Christ, you know, in their Mass. That is a big part of being Catholic, you know.
That's right.
And I can understand why. I've heard all the arguments growing up as Protestants and, you know, they're cannibals or all the negative stuff, but they've missed the beauty of it for sure.
That's
right. Protestants have in times.
That's right. Yep. Absolutely. But there's a real regard and reverent respect for the presence of God, and they just have it. They understand the same Christ, the same gospel, in just a slightly different way.
That's
the balance
for sure. Yeah. So Dale, is there a question you wished I would have asked you that you would have pounced on in this interview as we kind of begin to land the plane?
Well, you know, one related to justice would be, you know, one thing that trips people up is Dale, you're talking about having mercy on oppressors. Doesn't that just mean letting them off the hook? You know, like, shouldn't we resist? And like, what are some of the ways that we misunderstand mercy? That would be a question that I might try to answer, if that's all right.
Yeah, no, go for that.
Yeah, look,
I love it.
So a couple things. Humility is real humility is there's two ditches on both sides of the road. Okay, so one ditch is humiliation. That's not humility. That's
right.
Humiliation.
Yeah.
The other ditch is obviously exaltation of self. You know, I know I'm right. I know you're wrong.
I heard on that podcast, you said sin is either thinking way too much of yourself or way too little of yourself.
Mark Biddle, the Old Testament scholar, describes sin.
Well, it's not ears. That's it. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And mercy is similarly, there's two ditches. Like mercy is obviously not vengeance. You know, it's mercy, but it's also not letting them off the hook. Because mercy and humility can still hold critique and consequences and legal boundaries and all sorts of things that need to happen, but it's not seeking to demonize or tear down or destroy or eliminate. the other. It's merciful. And that's where that's the gospel tempering that puts on this whole conversation, you know. And we so need that. We need justice to have to be done in a gospel biblical framework.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like we've got to walk the road with people on both sides of that, those the oppressed and the oppressors, if you want to use those terms.
Yeah. And can I just say one other thing is that I was sharing some of this. I was doing a bit of a presentation on this at Laidlaw College during a course, and Dr. David Crawley, he had this great quote. He just said, "We have to." He said, "This is all good, but really, we can only take the drama out of our own eye." And so again, like, it might be very easy for me to take what I understand about this framework and what's wrong and why it's bad to have to demonize, why it's wrong to critique and all that stuff. But if I'm only pointing the finger at the demonizing and critiquing and rescuing that other people do, then I remain untransformed myself. And so for me, I just want to make sure that I'm not the one doing the blaming, rescuing,
yeah.
demonizing, retaliation, all those things.
Yeah.
I want to,
so
I'm the only one.
That's good advice for the person that has felt like, oh, I've been labeled as an oppressor. Well, what about these people that are just lazy and entitled? I guess that's an attitude that's got to be checked. Although there are people that are lazy and entitled.
I'm lazy and entitled, probably. Yeah. And I'm the only one I can change.
Yeah.
You know, really. I'm responsible to myself. And that's the profound thing. You know, like, I have to accept injustice, but continue to fight against it. And that's the strange paradox, right?
Yeah.
In one sense, accept is not the right word, because I don't accept injustice. But if I'm wearying myself out trying to play God, judge, mm-hmm. jury, and executioner, mm-hmm. I just don't think that ends up just adding more injustice,
yeah.
and it gets worse, not better.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I can see how I could possibly try and help coach walk the walk with an oppressor, somebody that was genuinely oppressive and racist or whatever. But I don't know if I could go to the other side, the person who I just, you know, talked about, the lazy, entitled person. What do you speak to them? If they call themselves Christians, but they're kind of Marxist, they're the social justice warriors that are, you know.
Are you talking about someone who's in a victim who's actually facing struggles themselves, or someone who's trying to help?
No, somebody that's facing the struggle.
They have
the victim mentality.
Okay.
All of their faults, their problems are the fault of someone else. Well, how do you help that?
I was doing a presentation to the Food Security Network on the North Shore that we partner with on the food drive in winter. And we were talking about some of the language that we would actually use on the front line with people that we're serving. You know, like, obviously, I mean, in the room, obviously we all agree it's just rude and incorrect and wrong to use language like, "You're lazy, get a job."
Yeah.
Now, there are some interesting questions that the government has asked of various institutions or organizations to ask of people seeking homelessness support. You know, like, did you have a part in your own homelessness? Can you stay with family? Those almost sound a little bit blaming.
Mm.
So we agree that that's not good language use. It's also, I think, unhelpful to say, "You poor thing, let me help you."
So what do you say?
What do you say? Gosh, that must be hard. Can I help? What Jesus actually gives us a model for this. He comes and he says, "What would you like me to do for you? What would you like me to do for you?" That involves their agency.
Mm.
I mean, and ultimately we're wanting to say, "I'm here to help, but I need your help to help you. You know, help me help you," kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I love the Good Samaritan story in Luke 10. Where, you know, long before there was anything called development theory and modern degrees that you could get, you have wisdom on two legs, Jesus Christ, wisdom with human skin on, telling the story in such rich detail that moves from the progression of aid on the side of the road. When the Samaritan looks after this person, they're beat up, half dead, they can't do anything for themselves. So oil, wine, put them on his own animal and takes him to an inn. But the Samaritan is not a rescuer. Jesus does not tell the story in such a way that the Samaritan is hovering around constantly trying to control the whole journey. He goes back to work,
Right.
He's like, I'll come back and check on you.
Check on him.
I'm paying. I'm invested. But, you know, you look after him. And this guy is in a community of restoration. And so it's just incredible the wisdom that Jesus has in telling that story. It's aid, but it's also development and it's empowerment and partnership.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Sounds like that's your passion. That's your heartbeat.
Oh, thank you, Todd.
Yeah.
It's just the wisdom of Jesus is urgently needed in my life, you know, to help me to not be a victim, a persecutor, or a rescuer. And I think that's good for the world.
Victim, a persecutor, or question to the listening audience is, which one do you identify with the most, the persecutor, the rescuer, or the victim?
For me, it's all three, if I can say, at different times.
Well, I guess so. We all wear the different hats. Yeah.
And that's what Stephen Cartman is, the psychoanalyst who devised the Cartman drama triangle. Part of his analysis is that we actually change roles. We swap roles. So if I, as a victim, take vengeance on the one persecuting me, I've now become the persecutor. Or if I'm a rescuer and my rescue efforts are not appreciated, then I start to feel like a victim.
Yeah.
You know, so we can switch around.
I'll see if, email me afterwards, that infographic, and I'll see if Rowan can slot that in here. Because it's interesting, and it's important. And I think some people are very visual, and we need to see rather than just hear it.
That's right.
Well, as we kind of land the plane here, let me ask you a couple of questions I ask most of our guests on here. One, Dale, is what waters your soul the most as a Christian? You know, sometimes people talk about their walk with God getting stale or whatever, but I started to do this or whatnot. What waters your soul?
Yeah, similar question. I was on a podcast called Where Do You Find God by Lizzie Oakes at Rema, and one of the answers that I gave her on this was, I just love and feel so nourished by vulnerable, honest conversations where, you know, like I have a few friendships with some men, we can just get really real, really honest, really vulnerable. There's something really special about that when we're not talking about our CVs or accomplishments, where we're actually talking about our vulnerabilities.
Yeah. Do you have a men's group? Do you have a men's group?
Yeah, a few probably.
Yeah.
It's good.
It's cool.
So important. And just really good friends that I can call and they call me or we catch up, we have coffees, you know, and it's just, we just know that we're there to get real.
Yeah. Cool. And I probably should have asked this earlier on, but what do you do to kind of keep your life kind of grounded and well-rounded? What do you have any hobbies outside of, you know, what you do in ministry and what?
Well, you might be able to see just behind me a strange looking object on one side of the couch. And that's actually a prayer kneeler that I built.
I see what looks like two pillows and then a little table.
Table that's like wood colored.
It's
a prayer kneeler. And that's something I made. I'm a woodworker. That's oak. It's made out of oak and it's got some tusked mortise and tenon joints. I love woodworking. So that keeps me just really happy.
I love it too. I'm not really good at it. I'm a wood butcher, but I like that kind of stuff. I thought you were going to give me a hyper spiritual answer. You see that prayer stool? I like to sit and pray for hours on end.
I'm a prayer learner. Yeah, I do love prayer, but yeah, that's the more honest answer.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So if you had a bit of advice for our listening audience today, a step that they could take to help live out their faith more authentically and more boldly and passionately, what would your heart's desire be? That Christians just finish the statements? That we just finish the statement?
And the answer that I'll give ties into Auckland Church Network and the Justice Conference stuff. So Christians just need to be curious with other humans a bit longer and not go straight to judgment and control. We need to be more curious and actually get to know the people that we're trying to critique and get to know people that we're trying to help. Get to know people before we thrust our opinions on them.
I love it. Would we live in a better world if everyone did that? I love it.
What a good question, Todd. It's a great question.
Thank you, buddy. Well, this has been Dale Campbell. Dale, it's been great having you on the show and bringing your unique insights. And where can people go? I mean, if they want to know more about you or the Auckland Church Network.
Yeah. Auckland Church Network.
Okay, and they can latch on to some of the projects you've talked about, the food, you know, the winter food giveaway, and
that's right.
Very good. And so for our audience, make sure you subscribe to the Thinking Matters podcast, and we're going to keep asking the hard questions and interviewing very interesting people like Dale here. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll tune in next time. God bless.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.